Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Slasher Movie Roundtable, Part 1, although we're at a square table. To my left is Annie Reese.
Hi.
Hi, Annie.
How are you? Thank you so much for... Oh, I'm good. I'm so excited to be talking about slashers.
So if you guys don't know who Annie is the co-host of Savor, one of our great... I mean, it's a food podcast, but it's food plus.
Food, yeah. I like that. Food plus. It makes me feel like I'm on Disney plus level. It's food and travel and drink. And yeah, we're really fortunate that we get to go to places like Hawaii and talk about food.
I get so jealous with your co-host, Lauren Vogelbaum, and also co-host of Stuff Mom Never Told You.
Yep.
Are you co-hosting anything else? Or is that it?
As far as I know, that is it.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. I'm glad to have a woman's point of view on slasher movies. Because, you know, we'll talk about inherent problematic qualities of slasher movies later on. So just put a pin in that for now. We have Joe McCormick to my right. Hello, Joe.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. You may remember Joe from last year's horror special, along with Robert, your co-host on Invention and Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
That's right.
You guys are in your, what, like probably eighth or ninth year?
Oh, God, I don't even know. Well, Invention's in its first year.
Well,
Stuff to Blow Your Mind has been around since, I think, like 2010 or 2009, something.
Okay.
I've only been on the show since 2015. Is that right?
Really?
I'm trying to remember.
It seems like you were always the co-host.
Yeah.
I know that's not the case, though.
But yeah, you know, we're cranking it over there. We're doing Halloween stuff all month, as we usually do. And we introduced that as a new tradition on Invention as well. So we've been talking about casket and coffin technology inventions all throughout the month. It's mostly inventions to... prevent people from being removed from caskets when they wanted to stay in, or to allow people to escape caskets when they wanted to get out.
Yeah, we did an episode on grave robbing a few years ago, and there was a lot of technology to keep people out of graves.
Yeah.
And technology, did you get to the one where there was a literal gun that would blast you in the face?
Oh, yeah. We talked all about that. Yeah. Turrets and, yeah. And there was a coffin torpedo that you could bury inside the coffin.
Oh, man.
There's a story about some grave robbers in Ohio. Oh, they had great names, but I forgot what they were. But they were digging up a coffin and they got, like, their leg blown off.
Well, that's what you get.
Wow.
And in front of me at the square table across from me, everyone, making his Movie Crush debut on mic is producer Ramsey Yunt.
Thank you for having me.
Woo! How you doing, Ramsey?
Doing well, doing well. I've been watching a lot of slasher movies over the past couple of days.
I think we're all a little bit on edge.
Yeah.
So I should set this up a little bit and say, well, first of all, let me say my piece, and then I want to ask everyone on a scale of 1 to 10 what your interest slash fandom level is for slasher movies in particular. But I'll start by saying that I'm getting into all this very late in life. I was a church kid growing up, as I've never stopped talking about on all my various shows. And it wasn't like I thought God would punish me, but it just wasn't in my sphere that much. Like the people I hung out with, these youth group kids didn't, you know, we were watching Big and Turner and Hooch. And I guess we were watching only Tom Hanks movies, now that I think about it.
Burbs.
Yeah, The Burbs, what else? Bachelor Party, although that was kind of dirty. But we just weren't – I just wasn't in this world that much. So, I mean, I watched Halloween and like Nightmare on Elm Street and some of the hugest tent poles. But I'm getting into this stuff later in life, and it's an interesting thing to do in your late 40s. And I was talking to Josh about this yesterday and how – and we'll get to Texas Chainsaw Massacre at some point. But just saw it for the first time. Very much disturbed me, and Josh was like, you know, you missed your window. Like, you're supposed to watch these when you're young and you feel like you're going to live forever.
Yeah.
And I went, you're right. That's the difference. Like, I'm 48. I'm going to die in the next 30 years, guys. I don't want to bring us down.
I didn't want to say anything, but...
you know? And so movies like this take on a different tone for me now, but... let's start with you, Annie. What's your 1 to 10 level on slasher picks?
Maybe like 6 or 7.
Okay.
I'm huge into horror.
Sure.
Slasher in specific is I like them, but they do often make me uncomfortable. I'm really nerdy, and I like to pick apart like tropes and what is this telling me about what society is really afraid of.
Right.
So I'm not super fun to watch movies with. But when I was young, when I was like 9, do you guys remember Media Play?
Oh, yeah.
No.
Yes.
Yeah, like don't you want a $35 DVD?
Yes. It was this big media store, and I grew up in a really tiny town, so we didn't have any source. I had to drive like an hour to get to anything.
What town?
Dahlonega, which is big now, but when I was there, it was like 5,000. It was really small.
So you were post-Gold Rush, pre-Gold Rush tourism.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So we would go to Media Play once a month on Fridays, and when I was 9, I tried to – I was kind of rebellious in my media because my parents were very strict about no PG-13, no
– Right.
So I bought Urban Legends, Scream, Psycho – and Sleepy Hollow, and they're all rated R, and I was 9, and they didn't check my ID.
So you're really sending a message to the folks, huh?
Yeah, and then when I was out in the parking lot, my mom made me check, like, what did you buy?
Oh, boy.
And I had to reveal what I had done, and she let me keep one.
Sleepy Hollow?
I kept Scream.
Oh, she let you pick the one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I thought she was like, no, you were only keeping Sleepy Hollow because I've heard of that.
Yeah, no. She let me choose one, and I kept screaming. I feel like that sort of changed the course of my movie slasher life forever because—
9 years old, Scream.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right.
I think I Know What You Did Last Summer came out soon after that. That was the first one I saw that really scared me, and now I watched it pretty recently. It does not hold up.
Oh, really?
Nope.
Yeah.
Freddie Prinze Jr., what were you doing?
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Or more importantly, what is he doing?
Oh, I don't know. What's he up to these days?
Where's that guy?
That movie's a 90-minute acting lesson.
But yeah. But it was very scary when I was young.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Ramsey, what about you? Where do you fall on the scale?
If you ask I was 9 years old for me, that's when I watched my first slasher flicks, and—
What is wrong with you people?
I was spending the night at a buddy's house in Pensacola, Florida, and Nightmare on Elm Street Part 1 and 2 came on HBO, and I watched both of them with my buddy and his dad, and we did not sleep a wink that night. And then— So my 9-year-old gauge was probably around a 7 or 8.
Okay.
Because that started it. I was like fascinated with slasher flicks after that. But now, I think I mentioned to you briefly, was like I have a child now. And so that kind of changes your perspective on things.
Sure.
And like I do watch gory movies from now to time and now again, but not as much as I used to.
How old are you now?
41.
See, I had no idea.
Yeah.
I've always wondered. If someone would have asked, I was like, Ramsey's either 28 or 47.
Yeah. Thanks, man. I appreciate it. But yeah, no. So like nowadays, I don't watch it. But every Halloween, I try to make a point to watch, you know, some of the classics.
Yeah.
Like we'll talk about like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Nightmare on Elm Street and all that type of stuff. But yeah, that was like the crowning moment for me. And after that, I was fixed on slasher flicks. But now, not so much.
All right, Joe, go ahead and explode the scale. Are you a 12?
Oh, no, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm like a 14 or something. But I mean, I don't know if I love most of these movies, but I've had a lot of formative social experiences watching them.
Okay.
So like you, I was a church kid, of course. Mm-hmm. I didn't like grow up on this, but I did get access to them through, you know,
through Satan.
The black magic of TV,
right.
You know. So when I was a kid, USA would run Friday the 13th movie marathons,
right.
I think. And they'd show a bunch of them on TV late at night. And I remember that being a very early window where I remember at the time being afraid of them, which is hilarious now because they're not scary to watch.
Uh-huh.
But they – at the time they were afraid, but they were also very enticing. There was something about them that was like – of course, there's the forbidden fruit kind of quality, but there was also like, I need to see what happens next. There was like some kind of crucial part of adult life that I was missing out on if I did not continue watching to see what happened, you know, when the knife goes in or something. It's a very bizarre kind of impression. I don't know what would have generated that, but I remember feeling like that. And then I remember also older kids I knew being into slasher movies when I was like in, I don't know, fifth or sixth grade or something.
Yeah.
And watching horror movies with them, watching Friday the 13th movies on TV with them. And yeah, as I went on in high school, I got really into just both horror movies genuinely and bad movies in general.
Uh-huh.
And of course, almost every slasher movie is horrible. Like you know, you can list the good slasher movies on one hand.
Right.
And so they brought a lot of interesting bad movie qualities that are fun to pick apart, you know, and to like kind of see what might be going on in the screenwriter's head that maybe even the screenwriter doesn't know.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I think you're all qualified.
Yes.
You're hired. You can stay. Noel, by the way, everyone, is in New York City hanging out with Questlove, so I think we can all say, fuck Noel.
Agreed.
You don't belong in this room. You go do your fancy music stuff. All right, so the first question I'm going to throw out that I threw out to the movie crushers is, what makes a good slasher movie? So think on that for a second, and I'm going to buzz through a few of these comments. Benjamin Johnson says the setting, something unique in the setting. Our old friend Gail Kuntz says you have to have someone trip multiple times before it's a slasher film. That's true. Ken Heitmuller says absurdity. Josh Brennan says perfect balance of tropes that work and creative uniqueness that keeps it interesting. And, of course, great jump scares. And one of our oldest friends, Rebecca Robe, says tension, suspension, creativity, and a truly badass villain and hero slash heroine. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and chime in with which one really – let me see here. Josh Brennan's comment really spoke to me. It's got to have something unique because I've sort of been diving in this week to some movies I've never seen before and – they're all very formulaic,
mm-hmm.
So you've got to have something else going for you. Otherwise, it's just a retread of Friday the 13th over and over and over. What do you guys think? Like, what makes a perfect – well, not a perfect slasher movie, but like what are the qualifications to even qualify?
I would say there's a really big fork in the road right at the beginning of answering this question, which is, are you looking for a movie that's actually good in terms of being suspenseful and scary?
Right.
Or a movie that is an enjoyable experience even though the movie itself might be bad and you don't, you know, necessarily care about the characters? I think that's the main distinction that it starts with. Caring about the characters and like wanting to see them escape mm-hmm. is a crucial thing. It's common to most of the actually good slasher movies, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Halloween,
yeah.
are the ones where you're on the side of the victims.
Uh-huh.
You don't want to see them get hurt. And when they're running from the killer, you're like, are they going to get away? Most slasher movies, I think, go on the other side where it's just kind of like there's an ironic detachment. It's almost kind of a curiosity
mm-hmm.
where you are just watching a series of somewhat annoying, kind of sexually charged characters
mm-hmm.
get dispatched one at a time. And the main motivation is like it's like curiosity. It's like you want to see how it's going to happen.
Sure. Annie?
I was curious about. Because over on Sminty, we just did an episode on Alien because it's the 40th anniversary. And I was like, is that a slasher? And I looked up the definition and it has to be – the internet seems to agree it has to be a humanoid character. There has to be a high body count.
And there should be some sort of blade involved in some of the killings, right?
I think
or
so.
No?
Like I mean some kind of sharp – yeah. Item. Yeah. Yeah.
I want to come back to the psychology of that later.
Oh, yeah, totally. I do too.
Yeah.
so well, much
even,
to say.
Even the body count, I mean, that's something I'm sure we're going to talk about. But like a lot of the classic slasher movies don't have a high body count.
Yeah, that's true. And especially I was thinking about this too of like I've been watching a lot of older slasher because I'm more familiar with newer slasher movies.
Mm-hmm.
And newer slasher movies usually have a higher body count.
Yeah.
And that's something – I think that's why I like slasher movies like Scream where I've seen the trope so much mm-hmm. that I really enjoy knowing that the people who made that movie saw them too and enjoyed them but then
right.
made fun of them and used them to kind of play with your mind.
Yeah. Which seems kind of not old hat now but I don't know if people remember or appreciate how original Scream was when it came out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because no one had really done that yet. No one had – made fun of the tropes and the movie within a movie thing. And I discussed that movie with comedian Nate Bargatze on the show in full, but because that's his favorite film. But Scream was really like pretty revolutionary at the time.
Yeah, and I remember when I saw it, it was my first slasher movie.
Yeah.
Well, I did see Nightmare on Elm Street, but I didn't really get it because I was like four. So I was, what is this?
Well, that's interesting that it was your first one, though, because they're making fun of these tropes that you hadn't seen yet.
Yeah. And so to me, I was just like, this is fun.
All right.
And then I got a renewed appreciation for it as I dove more into the genre. But they even say, I think in the third one where they comment on the body count getting higher and higher.
Right.
As we've gone on. But
How many dead bodies do we need?
Yeah. Well, to make a serial killer, it's only two.
Okay. But a slasher movie, two kills is not enough.
I mean, how many?
Can we all agree on that?
Just like three or something?
Yeah, Halloween doesn't kill that many people.
That's true. Yeah, but I feel like
there are five kills in the first Halloween movie.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you got the stats.
The kills.
Well, no, that's like a big thing for me. It was not a big thing for me, but it was just like that was like something like, you know, because I looked up like what is a slasher flick, and it was like body count and like, you know, Halloween, like Nightmare on Elm Street. I think it was like four.
Yeah,
and then Nightmare on Elm Street Part Two has the most because there's that big party scene. And, like, a lot of people die there. But the rest of the movies, there's, like, three people die.
Yeah.
And then some of the movies. But the body count is always is a big thing. And, like I said, you look at all these early slasher flicks, they're the setup, the establishment and all that was where they got you. And then there's, like, three or four kills.
Right.
Well, I tried to come up with a definition of slashers. Do y'all want to see if you're on board with this?
Sure.
Okay, so here's what seems crucial to me.
This is Joe McCormick's definition
okay.
of slasher
what
picks.
People think of when they think of a slasher, okay? So you got some kind of human or humanoid killer.
Okay.
Doesn't have to be human, but that has to be basically human-shaped, all right?
All right.
Murdering a group of hot young people in a sexually charged environment.
Yeah, that's pretty sure. – yeah, because that's just the whole deal of like punishment for doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not just the moralism. I think there's also something about like the blending of sex and death that seems to be a key appeal of
sure.
the genre. Yeah. Then it's using mostly bladed or puncturing weapons. Like you wouldn't see a slasher movie where the killer is like killing people with a car or a gun or something. It doesn't
agreed.
It doesn't make sense. It feels wrong. And then finally, the killer is unknown or mysterious, usually wearing a mask.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd say those are my main elements.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm on board with Joe McCormick's definition of slashers.
In my limited experience, there's a lot of unseen faces. There's a lot of puncturing and stabbing motions.
There's usually a shower scene.
Yeah, there's always a shower scene.
Maybe y'all have opinions on this now. Why is it always like knives, bladed weapons or puncturing weapons? Why does it feel like it doesn't make sense for a slasher movie villain to use a gun?
Well, I think it's much more intimate. And there is an intimacy to slasher movies in some weird, twisted way because the sex thing like you were talking about. And it's always, you know, you can shoot a gun from, I don't know, I don't shoot people, but it seems like you can get pretty far away from someone and still shoot them.
Yeah.
But you got to get right up on someone to stab them. It's very personal.
Well,
and scarier.
What I was going to add to what Joe was saying is like every slasher movie for me, it starts off in every town America or wherever, you
true.
Know,
mm-hmm.
So you have that feel like when you know what you're watching, it's either in a camp or it's going to be in some house. So like the home invasion type thing. So, you know,
it's never New York City though. You're right. It's always, this could be your town.
Except in Friday the 13th.
Yeah. Part 8. Jason takes Manhattan.
True.
Except only one scene there was actually filmed in New York City. The rest, I think, was in Vancouver or something.
The city of New York actually sued.
Yes.
Did they really?
Because they used the I Heart New York, but it was like Jason's mask.
Oh.
And also there's a TGI Fridays in the background.
Wow.
Scene, and I really love it.
Almost the entire movie takes place on a boat.
Yep.
But,
really?
Yeah.
Okay. You know,
but that is an outlier, yeah.
All right.
But yeah, and it's like, you know, Michael Myers walks into a kitchen, and what does he see? Oh, there's a kitchen knife.
Yes.
That's how I get my weapon. Mm-hmm. I'm invading into this house.
Yeah.
And it could be any street. Like, that's the whole point of Elm Street was they took the easiest, most relatable street in America at
right.
the time, and that's how they got Elm Street. I mean, it was, you know, in middle America, and there's, you know.
Because that's who you see in these movies, and that's a key point, I think, is, you know, you grow up in the middle of Illinois or Iowa or Idaho or Texas, and these teenagers are going to see these movies about towns that look just like theirs.
Yeah.
And that visceral experience, because it's not big city stuff usually, except for Jason, of course, at TGI Fridays. Well, another thing, too, is like we might as well just talk about the – and this is all – we should all just excuse ourselves for how demented this all sounds.
Yeah. Sure.
But we are talking slasher movies, so we need to talk about kill qualities. Like there – that's the whole thing is you got to have good kills, mm-hmm. and imaginative kills, ones that are like – you sort of laugh at maybe because you're uncomfortable with how gross it is, but I find myself kind of laughing at some of these lately when there's only so many things you can do with a knife, and there's only so many ways you can slit a throat or stab someone. Yet I keep seeing in the really good ones in new and inventive ways. We'll get into The Prowler a bit more later because I know we've all seen that, but straight through the top of the head, down uh-huh. through the throat. Yet that guy is still alive for way too long.
And his eyes, like, go back into his head.
Oh, that was fantastic. Oh, yeah.
Is the guy twisting the knife in his head, I think, to make the eyes go up?
Oh, is that what's going on?
I wasn't quite clear. Or it's a bayonet, maybe.
Yeah, definitely a bayonet. But, let's talk about kill quality and why that's so important.
I think it especially matters in the, like, of the two categories I laid out, like the suspense-driven versus the curiosity-driven. That's mm-hmm. way more in the curiosity-driven slashers, which are the vast majority of
right.
them. The suspense-driven ones, like Michael Myers doesn't do anything all that unusual when he's killing people
in
the first movie.
He's just stabbing away like any old regular schmo.
You know.
But I think that's because it's actually a good movie. It's driven by suspense. I mean, you're worried for the characters and you're seeing him in the background stalking. It's not really about the pure mechanics of the murder when
right.
it happens. But a lot of slasher movies, yeah, they're more this kind of like voyeuristic curiosity-driven thing where you just kind of want to see what are they going to come up with next.
Right.
And that's taken to ridiculous extremes in movies in the 2000s, say like the Saw movies, where they basically just take that principle like what's the weirdest, most creative
right.
way that you could kill somebody?
Yeah.
And so, you know, you go to like Rube Goldberg kind of levels.
Right.
But it also actually – that shows up in – something that maybe I'll ask y'all later whether this actually counts as a slasher genre movie, but the Final Destination yeah. movies, which have elaborate Rube Goldberg deaths, but there's no actual killer. It's just sort of a
right.
force of nature killing you.
Did not see those.
Yeah.
Oh, they'll make you afraid of everything.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Logging trucks, man.
I still can't
I
be behind a logging truck.
Every time
really?
I see, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I only saw the trailer for that one.
Yeah, like the first 5 minutes, this logging truck, all the logs fall off, and the next thing you know, they're flying through cars, and it's like, okay, never again. And
yeah.
Never again.
I think those are actually pretty fun. But yeah.
Movies or the logging trucks?
No. The Final Destination movies.
Yeah.
Well, I've only seen the first three, but those I think are pretty fun.
There's more than three?
Oh, there's like 17.
Yeah,
like straight to video type thing now?
I don't know. No?
Are they still theatrical?
I don't think they're
when did the last one come out? I don't know. It's been a while.
Yeah.
But yeah, you've got to like – you got to show something new if you're in the curiosity mode. And
right.
Like, there's only so many ways you can like stab or slash somebody. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it is like – in the later Friday the 13th sequels, for example, Jason's always trading out weapons. Now he's got gardening shears.
Right.
Now he's got a leather strap. Now, you know, it's just like going down the list to see what else could he use.
Yeah.
I think going off of that, when you watch – at least someone like me, if you've watched a lot of slasher movies, like every time I watch one now, I'm like, it builds tension just because you're looking at all the items that,
uh-huh.
oh, maybe it's that'll kill them.
Right.
Maybe it's that thing. Just like, what could it be? And so it kind of keeps you, again, if the movie is not necessarily great, it keeps you on edge the entire time because you're just thinking, oh, maybe it's
yeah.
that. There's something kind of fun about that, trying to guess. Like,
is it what would I do? Is that what it is?
There actually is some evolutionary science behind that
really?
You're trying to learn, like in a survival situation,
uh-huh.
what would I not do? And that's why some people enjoy horror movies a lot because they're just kind of picking up on, okay.
Is that the same sort of thing where I still do this where if I always had an object in the room that I would go to defend myself
yeah.
when I was younger.
Uh-huh.
And I still sort of have that sometimes. Like I know where the fire poker is. I
right.
know where the baseball bat is. Yeah. I know where the golf club is.
You've got a plan, a loose plan.
I do.
Yeah.
I guess I don't have a gun. That would probably be the most sensible thing to have in a home. But I'm just not into that. So
right.
Emily always laughs my wife about, you know, bring a gun in and just be prepared to meet the baseball bat. And I was like, yeah. I don't know if that's a fair fight, but let's just hope no one ever breaks in.
Yes. Yes. There we go.
Yeah. So evolutionary biology, there is a voyeuristic like – Or maybe, I know we don't want to imagine what it's like to kill people like this, but there is something fun about thinking about, like, what would I use? What weapon in that room would I use?
Well, to go beyond that, if we're talking about, like, you know, evolutionary explanations in neuroscience, I mean, there are things where I can't remember the exact name, but basically there's a case we were talking about on Stuff to Blow Your Mind a while back where a patient had a lesion, I think it was on the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that's important in generating the cascades of fear response, mm-hmm. you know. And so they had impaired fear response. Things that would normally scare somebody didn't scare this person. And the experimenter took them to a haunted house. And not only were they not scared, they showed strange attraction to all the scary things that popped out.
Oh, weird.
So like a monster pops up and goes, ah, and the person with the lesion on the amygdala doesn't just not react. They go up and they want to touch the monster. And like they touch the masks and go straight toward it. So I almost think that there may be a two-step thing going on in the brain when something is scary, which is first like arousal, and our natural reaction to that kind of arousal is like interest and you wanting to go near it. But then yeah. you get the fear response that causes you to stay away, retreat, and all that. But if you don't have that fear response, like if you've seen a lot of these movies, you've desensitized yourself.
Right.
It doesn't really scare you anymore. Instead, you've just got that arousal state and you kind of want to go up and touch it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's almost childlike.
Yeah.
Like before a kid knows how to be scared of stuff.
Yeah.
I wonder when that goes away.
For me, it was like eight.
Eight?
Yeah. Because, I saw Nightmare on Elm Street and I was like, whatever. But then when I saw Jurassic Park when I was like seven or eight, that really scared me.
Yeah. It's like a loss of innocence almost because I see it in my own daughter. She's four and she's fearless, which is great. And it's sad to see those things kind of go – you know, to the wayside and for them to start to be scared about things, you know? Ramsey, what about you? How old's your kid?
She just turned seven.
Is she scared yet?
She is. She doesn't like spiders. She's really into cooking shows now. And so when it
the
comes
– the scariest of all media.
Scariest of all media.
But
it's like on Chop right before like the time's up when they're done cooking, like that freaks her out.
Oh, yeah.
Like she gets so worked up and like she just like puts the covers.
Clock.
Yeah, the ticking clock like scares her.
It's called Chopped.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. But I have no idea what would happen if she watched something like Nightmare on Elm Street like I did when I was a child. That movie scared me for 2 weeks straight. Like I was
– You probably can't imagine showing your daughter something
Yeah,
like
I would
that.
Not do that. Like this guy's dad, my buddy's dad, showing that – well, he probably didn't know what it was. Like, you know, it was came out in, I think, what, 84 or something yeah. like that. It was just not – no one expected, you know, some guy to run around with razor blades or anything like that. So, I mean, it was just really crazy when that came out. But
– You know what scared me about Freddy Krueger? I remember distinctly was that he ran.
Yeah.
And I was so used to, even in my limited engagement with slasher movies, there's a lot of slow walking, which is one of the scary things about it, I think, that juxtaposition of like no matter how fast I run, they're walking yet somehow still right behind me. Mm-hmm. But Freddy Krueger ran and that freaked me the fuck out.
Yeah.
I remember still.
No, totally. And he also, the one thing that I always remembered about him and what I actually – As the franchise continued, was that he would actually speak to the victims.
Yeah.
So that was different. Like that was like one of the things that set it differently compared to like, you know, Halloween and the Friday 13th is like obviously there's no talking from the villain.
From any of them.
From any of them. So
yeah.
That always creeped me out. And even especially in the first one, you know, he kind of established like the one-liners throughout the movies.
Yeah.
But it was always like, yeah, you're dead because you know, that dialogue he had before, it was always pretty intense.
I'm your boyfriend, Nancy. I remember the tongue coming out of that phone.
Yeah. I actually went to go see Robert Englund at Dragon Con do a panel about Nightmare on Elm Street when him and his first kill was there, Tina. It was like and she was also in the Better Off Dead movie the same year, so it was like just hearing a little bit like tidbits and stuff like that. And he said like whenever they did the death scenes, they did two takes, one of him being straight up like killing and then doing the outtake, which would be him saying these one lines or making it cheesy or hamming it up.
Oh, interesting.
Just so like they could have that because the fans like that of the Nightmare on Elm Street series. So I mean, like it'd be interesting to see the because they always went with that hammy one liner. But it'd definitely be interesting just to see his.
It'd be
killing.
A completely different film.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's definitely more of it as the series goes on. By the time you get to Freddy's Dead, which is like six or something, he's just a stand-up comedian.
Oh, really?
Yeah. it's almost not a horror movie anymore. He's just doing jokes the whole time.
What's the deal with airplane food? Yeah.
Flash.
Well, and his kill, the glove with the knives, that was really original too at the time.
Yeah.
Because it took, you know, what's scarier than one knife? It's four. Or was it all five, I guess? Did he have a thumb knife?
I think it was just four.
Just four.
Just four?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's also made a very cool thing you could try and make for Halloween for a costume.
Yeah.
If you could get a gardening glove and, you know, attach some kitchen knives to it.
Christmas sweater.
I think my brother actually went as Freddy Krueger and he took a gardening glove and taped like plastic knives to it and stuff like that. So that was his thing.
What did he do with his face?
Oh, he had like the weirdest looking makeup on it.
Oh, really?
I have a photo of it someplace. I showed him, but it was just like plastered on type stuff that my mom did. It was not like the actual mask that came out with like years after that. But yeah.
Yeah, the best thing now on Halloween is to see like a 7-year-old in the Michael Myers jumpsuit and mask.
Yeah.
Like, that kid's doing it right.
Dressed up as Leatherface.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Can't believe I just saw that for the first time. But we're talking about that in part two. All right. So I guess let's talk a little bit. I promised that we would talk about inherent problematic qualities. That's the elephant in the room. These movies are misogynistic kill fantasies in a lot of ways for like the worst kind of people in society. Yet we all love these movies and women seem to love these movies based on the movie crusher responses. So what is it about these and like why can we look past that? I'm looking right at you, Annie.
I know. Like, can we look past that?
Yeah, can we? We do.
We do. Well, I've done a lot of research on this because, like I said, I'm a really big nerd. And over on Spinty, we've done an episode on Final Girl, which is a very big trope in slasher movies. Which is
what? Just the last one alive? Is that what that means?
Essentially, it usually has like a connotation that she's sort of gender neutral, like both in name and looks. She's virginal. She doesn't drink. She's kind of like the good girl.
Right.
She usually has brown hair.
Really?
Yeah.
In The Prowler, she has blonde hair.
I know. And see, I love that because I watch movies. I watch these movies and I've seen so many. I'm like, how interesting. Is this a statement or just like accidental? And as we've been saying a lot throughout this, like the voyeuristic quality, that's kind of the big problem a lot of people see with the final girl is that you're not relating to her, even though she's supposedly strong or, you know, she's a survivor.
Mm-hmm.
You're relating to the killer because you're seeing it from his point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a part of you that is like, if it's well done, you want the character to get away. But if it's not, then you're just like, whatever. Well, let's see. I'm trying to kill her, like all the different ways. And of course, there's always the shower scene. There's always some kind of punishment for sex. I love in Cabin in the Woods where they like play on that as well.
Yeah.
With the whore is usually the first to go. And with the knife, like there's a lot of theories about that, about it being a phallic symbol.
Right. Of course.
Used to kill all of these women. And there was a study done, I think in 2005, where it was looking at 1970s movies and then slasher movies and the remakes.
Uh-huh.
in the 2000s to see if the depiction of women has improved. And it found that the only way it's really improved is through the running and screaming, like that part of running away. Now that's more of a problem-solving element, so it is kind of a sign of strength.
Okay.
As opposed to just, like, I'm running and screaming, and eventually I have to confront this thing.
Right.
But everything else, some of them have gotten worse, some of the things they were looking at. So it hasn't improved that much. For me, women do watch horror movies at the same rate as men. And there's been a lot of speculation into why that is. And some researchers think it's because the endorphins that get released when you're watching a horror movie, that there's kind of women have this low level of anxiety all the time. Mm-hmm. So we really like that feeling of, I just released for a little bit.
Is it a thank God that wasn't me thing, I wonder?
I wonder. That's not what it is for me, but I can imagine some people watching it, and we hear all these stories about, like, if you go do this, X, Y, and Z, a horrible thing will happen to
right.
you. And so you can watch these movies and be like, well, I didn't go do that. There's
right.
kind of a judgment element of,
I didn't help a guy move his couch in his
right.
van.
Exactly. So yeah. I can feel good about, I am taking care of myself. There's some agency.
Yeah.
Involved there.
I mean, watching it as an older guy now, getting into these things, I can't help but think about young boys watching these movies. I don't think certainly that it can turn someone into a sociopathic killer, because that's a problem with the brain, you know, the actual chemistry of the brain or physical properties of the brain. But I don't know. I don't know if I had a son, if I would want my 12-year-old son receiving this message over and over and over.
Well, like,
not to get too heavy.
Yeah, no. Well, what you just brought up, I have some stuff I want to bring up with what Annie just said. Like the slumber party sorority type thing. You have, so when around these movies were coming out, you have the serial killer Ted Bundy, who committed his murders on Sorority Row at Florida State, and so like. Is there a correlation between his murders and what he did and also the time of what the movies were coming out? Because like a large part of these movies took place where people felt comfortable in their houses, especially women, very vulnerable. And then you got a house full of women. I mean, he's like, oh, where can I get this? Yeah, like just showing how these relate to at that time. Like these movies, I think, definitely had an influence in what was happening.
Oh, I mean, I've been wondering – I kind of wanted to ask you guys generally about why was the golden age of the slasher film like 1978 to 1984 or so?
Yeah.
What was going on in American culture then that made the slasher movie explode? I mean, was that just an accident because Halloween came out in 78 and it was popular? Or was there something in the cultural zeitgeist that wanted these kind of movies right then?
Well, one of the things I would argue is Roe v. Wade had just passed. And that was a huge anxiety now because men were starting to have concerns that they would not only have to raise children that they didn't want, they'd have to pay for them, spend time with them.
Right.
That
they're
maybe
on the
they would be responsible for this child. And also women were starting to enter the workforce.
Right.
And so they were getting more power, more agency. And there was a lot of social anxiety around that.
Yeah.
And there was a backlash of just like, well, these women think they have power. Well, let's just watch them.
I never considered that. I bet you that totally had a lot to do with it.
Yeah. Well, again, I've done all of this research on Alien.
Yeah.
And that whole movie was about like men, maybe you can get pregnant, or AKA you could have to raise a child.
Right.
And it was around the same time Roe v. Wade just passed.
Wow. And it was also and obviously just something as simple as Halloween being a big hit and it's Hollywood and they want to make money. That certainly had something to do with it. But it was also the time of, the 80s and the Satanic Panic and violence and crime were way, way worse back then. I mean, this is all a reality. We did a show on the Guardian Angels in New York and that dovetailed with movies like Escape from New York where they were like, in the future, you know, crime is so bad that they shut down Manhattan and made it into a prison. And this was just on people's minds. Crime was bad back then.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just the future. I mean, people – movies in like the 70s, 80s, and early 90s depicting New York in the present depicted it as hell on earth.
It was bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't – you know, that – you know, they obviously heightened that for films.
Yeah.
But when we were going over the Guardian Angels thing, like the crime rate statistics in New York City in the late 70s and 80s, it was something like – four or five murders a week or something like that, which is just crazy to think about now when you go to New York and walk around. You never, ever feel threatened or endangered for the most part.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And Texas Chainsaw Massacre starts off that exact same way. You think you're watching a newscast. Like it has news crew is there.
That's very effective.
And the voiceover sets you up like this actually happened. Like this happened in middle of nowhere, Texas. And for me, that just had that impact. One thing like that these slasher flicks all had in common for the most part was they were really low budget. Like they didn't have the money as these other Hollywood movies that are coming out. And I think that one of the things that you saw was like instead of seeing the villain, you saw through the villain's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was your perspective. So people thought like could easily think like, okay, now we're seeing it through their eyes. Where we are becoming that person in some sort of way, and it could definitely have effect on people depending on where they are. But like that was a scary part to me. Like you saw what the villain was going to do, and usually you would see them pick up the knife. You would just see the hand enter. So that definitely had an impact and scared the crap out of me too.
Ramsey, you just made me think about another important thing in the history of slashers, which is the economics of filmmaking.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about them being low budget. I think one thing a lot of slasher filmmakers may have picked up on is that, okay, so you're trying to make a movie that's going to grab people,
mm-hmm.
but you know, you don't necessarily know anybody who's got a really good script to work with. You don't know, you know, you don't have the budget to get a big star or something. What can you do that's really cheap that people will be, you know, like glued to?
Yeah.
And you found out that if you find a good makeup effects artist,
oh, yeah.
you mm-hmm. can do gore and murder scenes on the, you know, it costs pennies to do these things that look amazing. I mean, like Tom Savini's work in early slasher movies, I think really shaped the direction of the genre because there are these stories about when Sean Cunningham was directing the first Friday the 13th movie,
mm-hmm.
they had originally planned to shoot a murder one way, you know, that it was going to maybe cut away real quick after the knife went in or something. But then they found that Tom Savini's makeup effects looked so good that instead they just kept the camera trained on it and let you see more and more because, you know, they'd already paid for it. It looked great. They wanted to get more bang for their buck. And I think that sort of shaped the direction of the genre in the early 80s.
Right. Yeah, because you don't need elaborate sets. You don't need the best actors in the world. But you're right. If you've got a really good makeup and effects person, you can just throw a bunch of teenagers in the woods and make a movie for a few hundred grand back then, or today for that matter.
Well, to what Andy was saying about the female role, like if like in The Prowler, the most great I saw it last night for the first time and I was freaking blown away as far as like how graphic it was. And then, you know, I was like wondering why I hadn't seen this until that night.
Where have you been all my life, Prowler?
But like the most graphic scene was the kill was the pitchfork in the shower.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I was like, do you really need to hold on that for those like one more second? Like,
and lifted her up.
Lifted her up.
Pitchfork.
Yeah. And
they knew their audience.
They knew the audience. And like always one thing that's common is there's always probably going to be nudity in these movies as well. But like it was just really graphic and something about that. I was just like, this is I did not sit well. Like I got the heebie-jeebies watching that movie. But the same director who did that, I saw an interview with him on – because he also – him and Tom Savini did Friday the 13th part 4, the final chapter.
Yeah.
And there's a shower scene in that. They reversed the genders in there and they put the male into the shower and Jason just reaches through the glass shower and grabs him and puts his head up against the wall and it's basically crushes his skull. And like even that is graphic as well, but he – distinctly switched the gender roles there because of he was tired of these females being the center or defenseless in right. the eyes of the villains and all that stuff.
Interesting.
So. Quick side note on that director, Joseph Zito. So yeah. he made those slasher movies, but he also made Invasion USA.
Oh, wow.
Which I think you got a connection to, don't you, Chuck?
That was the one that where they destroyed Avondale Mall,
right,
if I'm not mistaken.
Chuck Norris defending Florida from being attacked by Cubans and right. Soviets.
Yeah, oh, wow. they drove a truck through Avondale Mall, and which is the mall I grew up going to. And it got a big facelift after that because the movie production had to pay for the, you know, for the rebuilding.
Wow.
All right, so let's finish up this part one with some questions. Ask for slasher movie specific questions here. And Adam Ron has a good one. What's the most no way that person could have endured that and still gotten up to run away or fight back scene you've ever watched? I'm just going to go with the one I briefly mentioned in The Prowler when the guy took the bayonet through the top of the head, all the way through his brain and out the bottom of his mouth, and he was still fighting back. That clearly would have been instantaneous death. So that's the one I'm going with. Anyone else got one?
I mean, I'd say Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The fact that like she's still running at the end. End of that movie, it is such an intense experience, and it is so harrowing that I feel like even just as a member of the audience, I could not get up and run. Like, you know. And so like she's been through this whole thing, and she can still like escape the dinner table and you know, run out to the road.
That's
I'm
a
like,
good one.
Oh man, I can't believe.
Yeah.
But they earn the ending in Texas Chainsaw, which I think it's like when she escapes in the truck at the end, I can hardly think of any movie that provides such an amazing sense of relief as that moment.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We're going to get into that in the next episode.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to spoil it.
Oh, no. That's all right. Do you guys have one? Can you think of one?
I don't have a specific one, but I'll say every time I think in – well, at least Scream 1 and Scream 2. I love how the protagonist can get shot and they're fine.
Yeah.
But the villain shot dead.
Yeah.
I think Gale gets shot in everyone. Dewey
oh, really?
Gets stabbed in everyone.
How many different ways Dewey get impaled?
Yeah. Yes.
Poor Dewey.
And they keep on going.
Yeah. That movie I used to think was so funny because they were constantly kicking the shit out of, I don't even know what you call the character. Did they have a name for the killer?
Ghostface.
But they were always kicking the shit out of him, whether it was like a coffee mug to the face or like kick to the balls.
It was like his buddy at one point is like, I'm feeling a little woozy.
At the end.
Oh, that's Matthew Willard.
Yeah. When he
cut me too deep.
What did he say? He says, my parents are going to be so mad at me.
Mad at me.
He was so like wonderfully over the top in
yes,
that movie.
Yes, he was.
The great Matthew Lillard.
He was.
Here's another good question. From Clement Scott, how do you guys feel about the 2018 Halloween? I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved that there were three generations of women in it.
It was pretty badass. I don't know if that's like fan service or what, but it felt like the right time to pull that out.
That's very rare.
And Judy Greer, I mean. Put her in everything.
Oh, geez, man. I hate to be the one person dissenting at the table.
Oh, you didn't like it?
No, I did not love it. I felt like they really missed an opportunity to do more with the character of Laurie in it.
Hmm.
I felt like not enough of the movie was about her, and it wasted all this time with these worthless podcaster characters.
Oh,
yeah. That was slightly annoying for many reasons.
Yeah, half the movie was just about them, and then they're just dead, and that doesn't really connect to anything else. And,
yeah, that's true.
I don't know. I was ultimately – I had really high hopes for it. I love the score, of course. You know, Carpenter's update. On the score was fantastic. I really liked some individual scenes in it, but overall, I was really disappointed that Laurie didn't get more room to grow and fill up the movie. I don't know.
All right,
I think I can see what they were going for at like a log line level. You know, the three generations of women and all that. That could have been great. I thought, but I don't know. I wanted more for Jamie Lee.
Gotcha, Ramsey.
I think my expectations for a slasher flick have gone down, so it definitely exceeded my expectations. I didn't really like the two Rob Zombie movies as much.
I didn't see those.
And so I was not expecting much. and I think it definitely exceeded my expectations. Is it a great film? Will I go back and watch it? No. I mean, but it's there. I was happy they did it. And I'm definitely going to go see I guess they're doing two more.
Yeah.
So I'll definitely go see those as well. But
so Ramsey's review, it's there.
Well, no, I mean, it's a slasher flick.
Sure. It wasn't offensive to you.
Yeah, I mean.
But it wasn't great.
Yeah, it's not going to be in my top 10 list or anything like that.
Fair enough.
But it's definitely where the Halloween franchise went even before the zombie movies. I mean, it's definitely filled a big hole and is definitely on the rise, I think. I mean,
well, you don't love Halloween 5?
Man, well, I don't know if we want to start, but like for me, like one of my biggest, as a child growing up and watching these flicks, I honestly, it was one of my downfalls was like my learning that, okay, sometimes your expectations aren't going to be there is like these movies started sucking, like
right.
Really getting bad. Like the kills were horrible. And like, it was like, what am I watching this for? You know, the appeal or whatever appeal, maybe my film taste got improved. I don't know. But like, it just like these movies were just, they're just throwing them out there and there's less time spent on even the kill qualities, even the story. If there is any, you know, it just got weaker and weaker. And yeah, Halloween 5.
Halloween 5 is like a bad time on ketamine.
It's such a bad
horrible,
film.
Altered state of misery and sluggishness.
I don't know which one that was.
But I have a love for them as what they were and what they are. But it's also like, yeah, now I watch these movies because like, okay, I want to see a bad movie. Mm. Like I'll go see a giant shark movie just because I know it's going to be horrible at the drive-in or whatever, and just because, or I'll get together with friends and watch these horrible movies. Like we'll watch Silent Night, Deadly Night because it's, you know, for what it is. I mean, which is a very bad film that we can make fun of while we watch.
Ramsey, you should never apologize for loving shitty shark movies.
You can go ahead and say The Meg.
The Meg. Right. I tried to get The Office to go. Tomiko went. That was hilarious.
I saw that on a plane. I fast-forwarded through most of it just to the sharky stuff.
I saw it on a plane, too. Yeah.
It's a good plane movie.
Yeah.
Because you're really far away from the ocean. Yeah. That probably had something to do with it.
I love Jason Statham in that movie. Is like, I mean, he's basically playing a pirate.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, what? Yeah. They got a shark in there. I mean, I'm not even exaggerating.
Yeah,
he was
pretty
piratey.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's wrap it up for episode one. I feel like we could do like 8 hours of this shit. Yeah. But we'll wrap it up for now, and we will see everyone next week for Horror Square Table Part 2.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.